of this vital arm of the Indian Ocean, as well as protection of its fragile ecology that risks being damaged by oil spills. ROPME, or the Regional Organization for Protection of the Marine Environment of the Persian Gulf, is the only bloc that is made up of all 8 Persian Gulf countries. Unfortunately, due to the divisive policies of the West, which since the colonial times has been interfering in the Persian Gulf, the unrepresentative and unelected regimes of the region have allowed the Americans to establish foothold in the area. Of late, certain regimes like the Al Nahyan of Abu Dhabi and the repressive Al Khalifa minority clan have made the grave mistake of setting up diplomatic ties with the illegal Zionist entity and thus providing access to Persian Gulf waters for the Israeli regime usurpers of Palestine. This is nothing but treason. And the Islamic Republic of Iran, as the paramount power of the region, has already served notice that any harm to the interests of Iran and the Iranian people will result in a devastating response aimed at the heart of Israel. The warning is thus loud and clear. Iran, as the principal supporter of the rights of the Palestinian people and the Campaign for Liberation of Islam's former Qibla, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, in the Zionist-occupied Islamic city of Beit al-Muqaddas, will certainly not allow the Israelis to spread their tentacles in the Persian Gulf. It is still not too late for all the Persian Gulf countries to overcome their petty differences and work together for peace and security in the interests of Islam and the Muslims of the region.
Ocean of Dua. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. وحبسني عن نفعي بعد آمالي وخدعتني الدنيا بغرورها ونفسي ومطالي يا سيدي فأسألك بعزتك ألا يحجب عنك دعائي سوء عملي وفعالي
Regarding this part of the Kumail supplication in which Imam Ali alayhi salam says يا سيدي فأسألك بعزتك أن لا يحجب عنك دعائي سوء عملي وفعالي We were discussing the concept of soul, also the fact that some hindrances, some impediments will block the way of ascension of our supplications to the Almighty Allah. we said that among the most important factors in blocking the way of supplications is the committing sins, which is caused by the alienation of the heart. And this is the direct effect of sins. Now, there are some obstacles and factors of the ascent of the deeds that are mentioned throughout our Islamic sources. Both of them have direct relation with the actions of man. The obstacles are the ones that hinder the elevation of deeds to the Almighty Allah, among which is supplication. But factors help in the ascension of the deeds to the Almighty Allah. We'll try to have a look at the first category, which is in question here, because Imam Ali alayhi salam is warning us about our deeds and acts that will veil our supplication from Almighty Allah. In this regard, Imam Baqir alayhi salam says, "It so happens that a person asks Almighty Allah for a need, and it is in his power to grant him his need in the near future. But the person commits a sin. So Allah, the Blessed, the Exalted, says to the angel, 'Do not grant his need and deprive him of it. For he has become the subject of my wrath and deserves to be deprived from me.'"
Oh Allah, my trials and sufferings have increased and my evilness has worsened. My good deeds have diminished and my misdeeds have become firm. And remote hopes restrain me from profiting with good deeds. And the world has deceived me with its allurements, and my own self has been affected by treachery and my delay. Therefore, my Lord, I ask you by your greatness not to let my sins and my misdeeds veil my supplications from you, and not to disgrace me by exposing those of which you have knowledge, nor to hasten my retribution for those vices and misdeeds committed by me in secret, which were due to evil-mindedness, ignorance, excessive lustfulness, and my negligence.
Thank you, Allah, let me hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So throughout our traditions, we have this very important issue that committing sin will act as an obstacle to our supplication, and sometimes it will be the obstacle of the ascension of all our deeds, not just our supplications. So what we need to consider in our minds is that there are some obstacles, there are some factors, on the other hand, which will elevate the deeds to the Almighty Allah when they are unable to ascend on their own. Some of these factors have appeared in a prophetic narration, which we do not want to refer to right now, but that I just said for our remembrance. So we understand from this word of Imam Ali alayhi salam that wrongdoing is a veil that prevents humans from receiving the divine blessings and mercy, as well as from the fulfillment of the supplications, except if the sinner repents from his sins. Evil deeds take away the desire and mood of supplication from the servant. Evil deeds will prevent the servant from coming to Almighty Allah's presence. Even if a sinful servant succeeds in calling Allah, even if he succeeds in asking him his requests, his supplications would not likely be fulfilled. Deprivation of the servant from the fulfillment of his supplications is in fact him being expelled from the mercy of his Lord, And it has been quoted from a mystical lover of Allah that it is harder for me to get deprived of supplicating than being deprived from its fulfillment. That is why we mentioned there are two aspects in our supplications. There are two benefits. The minor one is the fulfillment of supplication, but the greater one is that iqbal, that turning of the Almighty Allah towards the servant, that paying attention, that the servant knows there is someone listening to him, that the servant knows he has got the mercy, he has been bestowed the mercy of talking to his Lord, he has the remembrance of his Lord, and he is benefiting from the dhikr of his Lord. So in this part of the Kumail supplication, the supplicant beseeches to the Almighty and asks him, "My Lord, hinder the effect of my evil doing on the fulfillment of my supplications, so that I can keep on supplicating and you continue accomplishing my prayers out of your mercy." Brothers and sisters, we will, God willing, finish discussing this part of the Kumail supplication in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A recent report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States over the past year. In a news conference following the publication of the report, head of the council, Nihad Awad, described Islamophobia in the United States as deep and systematic.
Islamophobia has become mainstream in America. It made its way into the government institutions and public sphere through laws, policies, political rhetoric, and other manifestations.
Yeah, Islamophobia has been a huge phenomenon in the U.S. since 2001, when the September 11th false flag operation was deliberately used by enemies of Islam to trigger this tidal wave of hatred of Muslims and Islam that led to a series of wars that killed millions of people.
The report shows that the council received over 6,700 complaints nationwide last year, the highest the organization has recorded in 27 years, which represented a 9% increase since the year before. They involved a range of issues, including immigration, travel discrimination, law enforcement, government overreach, hate and bias, custody rights, school incidents, and free speech. Over 2,800 of the incidents were reportedly travel-related. The report cites last year's tensions in Afghanistan and the ensuing immigration crisis as the reason for such a large figure. The report also cites a 28% increase in complaints of hate and bias incidents, including the forcible removal of hijabs, harassment, vandalism, physical assault, and so on. The Council on the American Islamic Relations describes what it calls the Islamophobia Network as a decentralized group of actors, organizations, and individuals that share extreme anti-Muslim ideologies who lobby to influence government policy and public opinion about Islam. They include politicians, think tanks, scholars, religious groups, and activists that paint a distorted face of Islam and Muslims for political and financial gain. Listed among the top financiers of the Islamophobia Network, according to the council, are right-wing evangelical groups and pro-Israel organizations, most of whom are members of the Republican Party.
Islamophobia has not only been profitable for Zionists and the military-industrial complex and politicians, but also for these con artists who've created an Islamophobia industry that sells all kinds of books and drums up contributions, often at churches, and gets funded by these billionaire, mostly Zionists.
Back in December, the U.S. House voted for legislation to counter Islamophobia globally. The lawmakers voted along party lines, with the Democrats edging only 7 votes over the 212 that the Republicans had cast. It followed U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert's Islamophobic comments against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, one of the handful Muslim lawmakers in the U.S., earlier that month.
The Islamophobia industry comes up with all sorts of nonsense and sort of distorted, cherry-picked items from the religious tradition mixed in with all sorts of lies and kinds of grotesque accusations. And then it spams this out in mass, and so it's really polluting the entire infosphere.
The United Nations has called for the adoption of a global strategy that includes defeating all forms of violent ideologies. The question is how to execute such a strategy to make it appealing to all nations and people.
The conflict in Ukraine has raised the prospects of an all-out confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned about a real danger of World War III breaking out. In his comments to Russian media outlets, Lavrov added that given the current tensions between Russia and the West, the danger of a World War III was, quote, real. Lavrov also criticized Ukraine's approach to the talks and said if negotiations do not move in a reciprocal way, the negotiation process will be hampered. Lavrov also accused NATO of engaging in a war with Russia through a proxy.
I think that the U.S. and their allies have been pushing the world towards a sort of World War III or even a new Cold War mentality for months and even years now, with the kind of propaganda and various official lines that the United States and their closest allies like Great Britain, France, and Germany have been pushing against Russia.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba has criticized his Russian counterpart for warning of a real danger of World War III, saying Lavrov's comments indicated that, quote, Moscow senses defeat. Lavrov's warning came after the U.S. pledged more aid to Ukraine. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken paid a top-secret visit to Kyiv on Sunday and promised to supply more arms to Ukraine.
And I think that the NATO encroachments and the furthering of NATO interests throughout Europe as they get closer and closer to Russia's borders justifies some reaction from Russia. And the United States is going to continue pushing in their interest, which is only going to get us closer to World War III.
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in the Kremlin on Tuesday for talks revolving around the Ukrainian crisis. Putin said Moscow's move to recognize the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk was based on the Kosovo precedent set up by a UN-backed court. Following the meeting, the UN said Russian president agreed in principle to UN involvement in evacuations of civilians from Azovstal steel plant. Meanwhile, dozens of U.S. allies met in Germany to bolster Ukraine's military. Traditionally neutral countries of Sweden and Finland are also taking part in the meeting. The conference secured pledges from allies to sustain aid to Ukraine's military throughout this next phase of the war and beyond. The meeting saw a major pledge from Germany, which said it would deliver tanks to Ukraine in a radical switch in policy on the supply of military equipment to the country. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin added, the conference would transform into a monthly contact group on Ukraine's self-defense. According to a Pentagon official, at least 18 of the 19 towed artillery pieces Washington promised in the past 2 weeks have already been delivered to Ukrainian forces, and more are being rushed this week. In addition, Washington is supplying nearly 200,000 rounds of howitzer ammunition and is arranging for ammunition supplies for the Russian-made artillery that Ukrainian forces currently operate. France is sending its ultra-advanced Caesar mobile howitzer, and the Czech Republic is delivering its older self-propelled howitzers. Canada, too, is sending howitzers and advanced guided Excalibur shells that can travel more than 40 kilometers and deliver munitions precisely on target. The UK, on the other side, said it will send Stormer armored vehicles carrying anti-missile launchers to Kyiv. British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the country is also looking to provide Ukraine with long-range artillery and ammunition, as well as anti-ship missiles.
So I believe there is a limit to how far these countries will allow the United States to use them. And I think that when it comes to threats of nuclear war or the risk of a, you know, all-out World War III with Russia, I do think that we're going to see states in Europe start to stand up to that U.S. imperialism and try and go against them, maybe even allying with Russia themselves.
The European Commission insists that arming Ukraine is not about prolonging the conflict. However, a growing number of civil society organizations and lawmakers in the European countries believe the West should be prioritizing peace talks over arms delivery. Moscow has warned Western countries of the unpredictable consequences for arming Ukraine. Russia says it views Western military supplies to Ukraine as legitimate targets.
Israel is stepping up its atrocities against Palestinians. Israeli forces have shot and killed a young Palestinian man in Jenin. The man was identified as 21-year-old Ahmed Mohammed Lutfi Massad. He was a resident of the town of Burkin. He was killed during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the early hours of Wednesday. Officials say Massad had been shot in the head. Three other Palestinians with moderate wounds were transferred to the medical facility as well. The Israeli troops broke into dozens of homes and violently searched them, causing excessive property damage before detaining at least three Palestinians. Massad's death follows that of another Palestinian killed on Tuesday when Israeli forces stormed a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. 20-year-old Ahmed Ibrahim Uwaidat was killed during the shooting in Akabat Jaber camp near Ariha. Nearly 50 Palestinians have been killed by Israelis since the start of 2022. Jenin has become the target of increasing Israeli military raids, arrests, and targeted assassinations in an attempt to crack down on growing Palestinian armed resistance there. The regime in Tel Aviv has escalated its crackdown on Palestinians since the beginning of the Muslim holy fasting month of Ramadan. It has also arrested dozens of Palestinians in the occupied East Al-Quds and desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Well, I think clearly Israel is trying to provoke the Palestinians. You know, this is just part of their long-term campaign of wanting to take more and more land from the Palestinians. To take over holy sites in Jerusalem that they want for themselves. And again, they're trying to provoke a response that would justify a greater military incursion, I think, into places like the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Damascus Gate.
The regime has further imposed new restrictions on the Palestinian people's entry into the mosque and ordered the demolition of Palestinian homes and agricultural facilities. There are fears of a possible large-scale Israeli invasion of Jenin camp. The armed wings of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Fatah movements are active there. Last week, settler incursions under police protection led to daily confrontations with Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Many Palestinians were injured and arrested. The Palestinian resistance movement of Hamas has also harshly warned Israel against further atrocities against Palestinian people. Hamas says Israeli threats would not discourage the Palestinian people from keeping up their legitimate struggle against the occupying regime.
Well, again, I think Israel's plan is to take over all of Palestine, to push the Palestinians farther and farther out of, in particular, the West Bank, but also Gaza. I mean, it's really a genocidal plan, right? I mean, the plan is either to starve out the Palestinians, force them to leave as refugees, as many have, so that Israel can take over the entire, piece of land there.
The heightened tensions come as people around the world are gearing up for Quds Day rallies around the world. The annual event is held on the last Friday of Ramadan. It was initiated by the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, in 1979 to express solidarity with Palestinians and staunch opposition to Zionism. Palestinians have called on Muslim nations to play a more assertive role in securing the cessation of the Israeli regime's occupation.
The Israeli-Russian ties have been deteriorating rapidly over the past few weeks. Most recently, Russia's ambassador to Israel, Anatoly Viktorov, has warned that Moscow will introduce retaliatory measures against Israel in case the Tel Aviv regime supplies Ukraine with military equipment and aid amid the military conflict there. Viktorov issued the warning in a televised interview on Thursday. It was not immediately clear from the Russian envoy's remarks what such a response might entail.
And I think that we'll see strengthening of cooperation and increased military support for Syria and other regional partners of Russia in the region if Israel goes along with supporting Ukraine. And it's important to note that Ukraine has said that it wants to be in Israel. It wants to be Israel in Europe. It doesn't want to be absolutely liberal and European.
The comments came a day after the Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Israel will provide Ukraine with helmets and flak jackets. Last week, the Russian Foreign Ministry summoned Israeli ambassador to Moscow after Tel Aviv denounced Russia's military operation in Ukraine. It came after the Israeli Foreign Minister accused Russia of committing war crimes in Ukraine alleging that there was no justification for Russia's military campaign against its western neighbor. Earlier this month, the Israeli regime voted in favor of a United Nations General Assembly resolution suspending the Russian Federation's membership in the UN Human Rights Council. The move was made over claims of gross and systematic violations and abuses of human rights in Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry called the resolution, quote, unlawful and politically motivated. Taking a sideswipe at Israel and the United States, the Russian Foreign Ministry has said that the longest occupation in the post-war history is being carried out by Israel with the tacit approval of the West. The ministry further bashed the blockade of the besieged Gaza Strip, which Israel says is needed to prevent arms from reaching the Palestinian resistance movement in the enclave.
Well, one of the things that it's important is that Israel saying that Russia has committed war crimes is laughable, since Israel itself has been liable and the charges are severe to their war crimes and human rights violations against the Palestinian people, most recently in the war on the people of Gaza just last year in 2021.
Ukraine has asked Israel for weapons and equipment, including the Iron Dome missile system, something that Tel Aviv hasn't publicly approved so far. Russia has said that foreign weapons sent to Ukraine will be fair game for its military attacks. If Israel decides to sell arms to Russia's western neighbor, will there be a conflict between the two?
So I think it's not yet sure what's happening, but I think what we are seeing is a shift of Israel from being neutral in this current special military operation to openly supporting Ukraine. So it might shift, but it will cost them. It'll cost them heavily because Russia is an important player in Israel-Palestine.
Since Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a special military operation in Ukraine on February 24 and officially recognized the breakaway regions of Luhansk and Donetsk as two republics, the political lines across the globe have been getting redrawn. As Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned, that risks the situation spiraling into a third world war.
In the limelight. The definition of a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth. So ruled the veteran Washington journalist Michael Kinsley, who would surely take delight in the textbook example of the form served up on Thursday, 28th of April, by Jacob Rees-Mogg, the satirically titled Minister for Brexit Opportunities. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland. The piece is titled, Jacob Rees-Mogg Has Given the Game Away. Even this government knows Brexit is a disaster. The definition of a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth. So ruled the veteran Washington journalist Michael Kinsley, who would surely take delight in the textbook example of the form served up on Thursday, 28th of April, by Jacob Rees-Mogg, the satirically titled Minister for Brexit Opportunities. On a visit to the Eurotunnel terminal at Folkestone, high-visibility gilet over his double-breasted suit, Jacob Rees-Mogg announced that the government was delaying yet again the imposition of post-Brexit border checks on imports from the European Union. He asked the public to celebrate this decision on the grounds that it would save £1 billion a year and help hard-pressed consumers by avoiding an increase in the cost of imported food. Enforcing post-Brexit checks, said the minister, would have been an act of self-harm. You read that right. Jacob Rees-Mogg, the arch-leaver and long-time loather of the European Union, is now parroting lines from the Remain campaign. He's admitting that implementing Brexit in full, honouring the 2016 promise to take back control of Britain's borders, would be an act of self-harm. There's plenty to attack here, starting with the nerve of hailing this move as saving Britain's £1 billion, when this was £1 billion that Britons would never have had to spend at all if it hadn't been for Brexit. Or you could share the outrage of British farmers, appalled that thanks to Brexit, they have been left at a serious competitive disadvantage. They now face onerous and costly checks when they ship their goods across the Channel, while French, Italian and Spanish farmers face no such hassle moving their farm produce in the other direction. Or you could worry along with the British Veterinary Association, which warns that not checking food imports leaves Britain exposed to catastrophic animal diseases, such as African swine fever, a risk that was reduced when Britain was part of the European Union's integrated and highly responsive surveillance systems. Or you could join the lament of the UK Major Ports Group, whose members have spent hundreds of millions of pounds building checking facilities, which now stand unused as bespoke white elephants. But put all of that aside for now, just for a moment, and grasp the full meaning of Jacob Rees-Mogg's admission. He and his fellow Brexiters once looked forward to these border checks, seeing them not merely as a price worth paying for leaving the European Union, but as a genuine benefit. Britain would at last be free to set its own food standards superior to the European Union's. And yet, now the minister admits that putting up barriers just makes food more expensive for British consumers and risk bankrupting British farmers. Precisely the act of self-harm that Remainers always said it would be. The irony of hearing Jacob Rees-Mogg declare that free trade is hugely advantageous to consumers after he and his comrades pulled us out of the largest, most successful free trade bloc in the world, namely the European single market, would be funny if it weren't so bitter. At a stroke, the Minister for Brexit Opportunities has implicitly admitted that there are none. Or, at the very least, any opportunities are outweighed by costs so great that they represent economic self-mutilation. In the long story of Britain's needless and pointless departure from the European Union, the Rees-Mogg admission should count as a milestone. Which is not to say the Conservatives won't keep banging the Brexit drum, hoping it will rally the electoral coalition it summoned back in 2019. But the sound, always hollow, will now be hollower still. Thanks to Jacob Rees-Mogg, the Brexiteers themselves have admitted as much. This matters not just as a twist in the Brexit saga, but for the life expectancy of this government. For Brexit was this government's founding purpose. When the best that even the loudest advocates for that project can promise is a delay in its realisation, it's clear the drive has gone. And without such a goal, a destination to aim for, governing parties drift and become vulnerable. If the two usual determinants of an incumbent administration's popularity are the economy and the personal standing of the leader, those now combine dangerously for the Conservatives. The cost of living crisis is both deep and wide, reaching into families that had previously been getting by, albeit with a struggle. It's the mother living off a tin of soup, for herself so that her children can eat. It's the parent getting the kids to change into pajamas when they get home from school to avoid wearing out their school uniforms. But this crisis runs in parallel with Partygate, each revelation of indulgence at No. 10 Downing Street affronting not only those who followed the rules and denied themselves contact with loved ones during lockdown, but all those who do not have the money to put bread on the table, let alone pay for a suitcase full of booze. This is a Marie Antoinette government, pampering itself while too many of its people go hungry. The usual alibis are no longer working. The much-trumpeted vaccine rollout is increasingly upsetting the public mind both by Partygate and the handling of the first phase of the pandemic. Witness this week's High Court ruling that discharging people from hospitals into care homes was both irrational and unlawful. A new opinion poll shows a sharp decline in the number of voters ready to forgive those early decisions just because they're glad they got the jab. Nor does law and order any longer offer its traditional comfort to the Conservatives, not when new figures show overall crime has increased by 18% in the past 2 years, with the proportion of those charged down to just 5.8%. On almost every issue, from inflation to immigration, from tax to housing, and the National Health Service, big majorities think the government is handling things badly. Only on defence and terrorism do the Tories get positive marks. No wonder they like to hail Boris Johnson as a leader on Ukraine, though that is of limited political value. Most voters surely sense that today's Labour Party would not be doing anything different. In normal circumstances, you would say this spells doom for Boris Johnson. He lags behind Labour and Keir Starmer on the two big ones, the economy and the leadership. People are far worse off than they were, and they have lost all trust in Boris Johnson. His government is stripped of its defining purpose, leaving it exposed to daily squalls and scandal. And yet, while the evidence is strong that voters are making the break from this government, they're not yet fully sold on the alternative. The old line says it's governments that lose elections rather than oppositions that win them. But changing governments is a two-stage process. First, the electorate moves away from the incumbent party, then it moves towards the challenger. Labour and Keir Starmer have work to do on that second stage. But the first phase is well underway, and Jacob Rees-Mogg's accidental truth revealed one reason why.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
These days, it's easier than ever to get lost in the virtual world. A unique museum in the U.S. is using augmented reality for visitors to plug into a thrilling experience about the Earth's environmental challenges. The New York Museum is called Arcadia Earth. It offers a large-scale multisensorial journey through underwater worlds, mountains, savannas, and inspirational fantasy lands. Each exhibit is brought to life through immersive technology and animated by augmented and virtual reality, including projection mapping. One installation is made of 44,000 plastic bags, the amount used in New York every minute before a plastic bag ban was implemented. The museum founder says the goal is to raise awareness about the impacts of climate change in a fun way.
The intention is to inspire people to come and leveraging game and immersive beauty to deliver a message. And I think that if this technique were to be used in school, we will so learn much more, and every kid will want to go to school. And at the end of the day, the purpose is just to deliver the message. The tools are just techniques. So I really think that this technique, it's super fun and will work for everyone.
Vittori added that the experience is meant to encourage people to be proactive in protecting the planet. The exhibit also spotlights other environmental challenges, such as overfishing and food waste. Proceeds from tickets sold are used to plant mangrove trees. This exhibit has been held in several cities across the United States, and each time proceeds have been used to support various environmental causes. Appearing like something straight out of a sci-fi movie, this Gundam-style robot lifts off special equipment and carries out maintenance work on out-of-reach railway contact lines in Japan. Developed by West Japan Railway Company JR West and two other Japanese companies, the humanoid robot can conduct repair work on overhead wires, which are considered high risk for humans. According to JR West, the prototype of this robot can be controlled by human operators through VR helmets and remote controls. It can lift objects up to 40 kilograms in weight with two hands to a height of 10 meters. It was designed to lower the risk of electrocution and falling for workers. The company says it can cut down human labor by a third. The company has been conducting tests since April and expects to put the robot into full service by early 2024.
A child-sized doll screams and rolls its eyes while lying on a table as engineer Hiroki Takimoto looks on calmly. But instead of being a child's toy, the doll is a humanoid robot mimicking critical medical symptoms designed to train dental workers. The robot was co-developed by Japanese robotics startups Team Sock and a local dental school. Pediaroid was designed to stimulate a child's responses when receiving dental treatment, including changes to its medical condition. Using a tablet programmed with different medical conditions, the user is able to send signals to air cylinders installed within the robot's joints to move its entire body, mouth, and tongue to display physical reactions and facial expressions.
Medical workers really need to experience medical emergencies. It's important that they experience a situation where something goes wrong, and that's what it can simulate. As for the future, we would like to further develop it in such a way that various other people who are involved with childcare, such as mothers, elementary school teachers, childcare workers, and nurses, can experience emergency simulations.
Director of Team Sock's engineering division, Yusuk Ishii, said the robot was developed due to the lack of clinical dental training to treat children. Currently, at a hefty price tag of about 25 million Japanese yen, Team Sock hopes to develop the hyper-realistic robot further such that people from other childcare industries, including pediatricians and elementary school teachers, would be able to use it for other emergency situation training. Iran has hosted an iftar dinner in support of Palestine amid a rise in Israel's violence against Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan. Yusuf Jalali reports from Tehran. Let's check it out.
Turn the pot over to let the tasty maghluba slip into the dish. Maghluba is a Palestinian upside-down rice, usually cooked with chicken or lamb. Now, these Iranian and Lebanese women have taken part in a group cooking of maghluba as a solidarity gesture with Palestinian women amid the escalation of the Israeli violence against Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque. They say maghluba is not just a delicious food, but a symbol of the downfall of Israel.
Maghluba is indigenous to the Levant area, such as Lebanon, Syria, and especially Palestine. The last stage of the food's recipe is to run over the pot that contains the food. Today, it has become a symbol of victory for Al-Quds and a defeat for Israel.
Turning over the pot symbolizes the downfall of Israel. Interestingly, Israel has imposed a ban on the entry of pots into Al-Aqsa Mosque since they have come to learn about what it means to turn over the maghluba pots.
Since the start of the month of Ramadan, Israeli forces have been assaulting Muslim worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, injuring scores of people. The escalation in tensions has drawn worldwide condemnation, with protesters calling on the UN to take action to end the regime's crackdown against Palestinians.
Palestine is for Palestinians. Israel has been repeating its barbaric behavior towards Palestinians since 7 decades ago, and today it has taken its violence to another level by doubling down on its use of force. I think they are angered by Palestinians' resistance, and that's why they have resorted to violence.
This humanitarian move is one of tens of solidarity gestures staged in Iran and worldwide in support of Palestinians. The event also comes ahead of the International Quds Day, a global pro-Palestine rally that takes place every year on the last Friday of the month of Ramadan.
Enjoy the maghluba and wish Palestinians good luck in their struggle against occupation. Chefs here say, aside from symbolizing the victory of Al-Quds against occupation, this event seeks to raise awareness of the Palestinian suffering and to call on other nations to jump on the wagon and voice their support for Palestine's resistance. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A museum in France is hosting treasures of Peru, including the famed Machu Picchu, in a unique experience where technology meets archaeology. Visitors can immerse themselves in a vertical tour of Machu Picchu Citadel and see an exclusive exhibit of Peruvian archaeological objects. The collection is arranged chronologically, passing through the extraordinary diversity of some 13 cultures. The collection displays 200 artifacts spanning 3 millennia, dating as far back as 1500 BC. A large part of the exhibit is dedicated to Peru's Machica civilization with their vase portraits and red ceramics. The museum's curator says the goal was to show that pre-Columbus Peru was far deeper than just the Inca era. Iran's National Museum is displaying a collection of artifacts that was stolen decades ago but has finally returned home after a long legal battle. The items, which include sacred figurines, pots and jars, date back to more than 3,000 years ago. They were stolen and sent to the West more than 4 decades ago. In 1991, the British Museum was seeking to buy the collection from a smuggler residing in Switzerland. The objects, however, were seized by Swiss police and revealed in court in 2008. Since then, Iran had been trying to get the stolen treasures back home.
Under pressure from the Iranian diplomatic apparatus and the official complaints of the National Museum in 2015, the legal process continued, and finally on December 20, 2020, the collection returned to us.
The collection belongs to the northwestern city of Bukhan, which was the home of Manians around the 10th to 7th centuries BC. The Manians were one of the first nomadic tribes to build cities in that area. The director of Iran's National Museum says the effort to recover other stolen artifacts continues. The country is now holding talks with the U.S. and Australia to return ancient objects smuggled over there.
How long could you work at your job? In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit. You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do. And there, you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here, and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Ortman says his secret to a long life and breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Orthman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity.
Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community. Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. One of the employees describes how they turn barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, but since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most.
IRIB English Radio.